is Bird Note. A rakish, eye-catching crest really sets some birds apart. Picture the blue jays of the east, or Stellar's jays of the west. A jay's crest is made up of a slender array of feathers on top of its head. These feathers are a bit longer and can be spiked up or slicked back, depending on what the bird is trying to communicate. When jays are sitting on eggs, feeding their young, or hanging out with their mate, their crests lie low. But in the case of heightened arousal, like in courtship or conflict, a jay's sharply raised crest tells a tale. The same goes for northern cardinals, and perhaps most crested birds. Even birds without crests, like crows or sparrows, sometimes puff up their short crown feathers. Why some species have crests and others don't remains a complex evolutionary question, dating back to the dinosaurs. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Jim and Birte Faulkner and generous listeners around the world.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions. You're listening to A New Dimensions Archive Edition. Recorded in 1996.
Some of the most interesting stories of our time are emerging in the intersection between the secular and the spiritual. One is the attempt to find a new vision for America that has the authority and power of a religious vision, but that is inclusive, not sectarian. One that encourages an ethic of cooperation to balance the economics of raw competition. These are the words of our guest today, Bill Moyers, who continues to bring an original voice and vision to television. In the fall of 1996, he, along with an extraordinary team of producers, scholars, artists, psychotherapists, writers, and philosophers, introduced the American viewing public to a unique television event, a 10-part series, Genesis, A Living Conversation. This is an exploration through dialogue of the first story for those of us raised in the West and the Middle East. Genesis and the Old Testament serve as the foundation stone for three great religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. From the creation of the world through the founding of Israel, from the architecture of the cosmos to the intrigues of the patriarchs, from Adam and Eve naked in the garden to Joseph strutting in his coat of many colors, from fratricide to reconciliation, for more than 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, not to mention the world's greatest writers, have plumbed these stories from Genesis for their religious, moral, and ethical implications. For years, Bill Moyers has sought to demonstrate the appeal of religion and philosophy as journalistic beats, with such series as Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth, Amazing Grace, God and Politics, Spirit and Nature, and The Wisdom of Faith with Houston Smith. His career as a television journalist has earned him many honors, including election to the Television Academy of Hall of Fame. His reporting and interviews have been the basis for several best-selling books, including Listening to America, The Power of Myth, A World of Ideas, and Healing in the Mind. Join us for the next hour as we explore the provocative and inspiring work of Bill Moyers. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Bill, welcome.
I'm glad to be here, Michael.
What was the inspiration for Genesis? Where did you get the idea from?
I saw a story in the New York Times a number of years ago that referred to the best conversation in New York. Well, that intrigued me. I love the world of ideas, and I really relish good conversation. So I called up the rabbi who was mentioned in the story, Rabbi Burton Vysotsky, who teaches at the Jewish Theological Seminary on the west side of New York. That's the academy of the Judaism's conservative movement in this country. He'd been having for some years, a couple of 3 years, a group of biblical scholars, Christians and Jews, screenwriters, novelists, poets, essayists, philosophers, and laymen and women, to work their way verse by verse, story by story through Genesis. I went up at his invitation. I called him, said, "I'd like to come. I've heard about this. Come on," he said. I was a fly on the wall. I tell you, it was a fascinating discussion. Here were a group of people who were discussing this text as if it really mattered. I was there that first night when they were talking about Joseph and the story of Potiphar and Potiphar's wife. And I'd never heard people go at ideas like this, biblical ideas like this. They were exchanging ideas. They were challenging each other. They were inquiring of each other. They were forcing each other to back up and think through what he had just said or she had just said. And I felt I was in the presence of the best dinner conversation I'd ever heard in my life. And ideas were popping in my own head as I listened, like fireworks on the 4th of July. And I said, "I've got to bring this to television." I asked them to let me bring my cameras into their sessions, which were going on the last Thursday of every month, record them for a year, edit them down, and put them on PBS. They thought about that and then very rightly and wisely said, "No, we think that would destroy the intimacy of the group, the community that we've developed here, so we'd prefer not to do it. We just will do our own thing here in the basement of this seminary." So I then set out to try to create our own Genesis seminar because I thought we could show people how exciting it is to talk about these ideas.
One of the things I noticed in seeing some of the video clips is that people sat in circle. It wasn't like you were sitting around a rectangular table. And that somehow seemed to me to enhance the dialogue and the participation, and everybody kind of was in an equal role, equal position.
I love the symbol of the circle as inclusive, as everyone being contained in within its perimeter. And we wanted to create that sense of a community, a sense of a circle, an inclusiveness in these discussions. We have people from many faiths and people of no faith. Robert Redford had a little tag at the end of the movie, A River Runs Through It, that said no fish were harmed in the filming of this movie. Well, I wanted to put a tag on this that said no agnostics were harmed in the taping of this series, because we have some agnostics there, people of skepticism, people who haven't taken these stories for a leap of faith. And the circle is a marvelous symbol of that inclusiveness, and it also enabled us to film this, tape this, with four cameras floating on the circumference of that circle, so that you, the viewer, are brought into it as if you are an eavesdropper in your own living room to a group of people who have come there to talk, and it creates an atmosphere of participation on the part of the audience.
There also was lots of disagreement in looking at the dialogue in the book of the same name, Genesis, A Living Conversation. There was lots of disagreement, lots of heated kinds of exchanges. What about that?
Well, the passions grew. The more we moved beyond the superficial politeness that used to pervade in the ecumenical dialogues of the 40s and 50s, don't get me wrong, those were valuable. We made some connections back then, but people fudged their differences for the sake of apparent harmony and went away not really knowing much more about the Jewish view or the Christian view or the other view that might have been there. In our discussions, I encourage people to really be candid, to stand up for their principal beliefs and to listen to others as they stand up to their principal beliefs, so that the passions rose and there were disagreements. The more we talked, the more we disagreed. And yet, we discovered that even within our disagreements, we shared some very important things in common with people who were unlike us.
How much tape did you actually roll? I mean, having eight people in around a circle and getting everybody to participate at least to a level of somewhat equality, that's a real challenge. So tell me about that.
For a while, the best discussions took place at the coffee urn after the first hour of conversation, because people were still, they wanted to speak from some official position of authority. The biblical scholars who came felt that they had to uphold the official position of their particular academy or their particular approach. They got over that at the coffee table. I'd have to rush out. I'd stay in the set while they were having coffee, working on my notes. I'd have to rush out and say, calm down. I'll come back in and let's start recording. This is exactly how I want you to talk. For a while, people were stilted. But after that first hour, they really began to open up. And we taped about 4.5 to 5 hours for every hour that we put on the air.
Yeah. How did you go about selecting people to participate?
I had a single criterion, twofold criterion. First, everybody had to be seriously committed to these stories. They didn't have to be a believer. They didn't have to be devout or pious. But they did need to take these stories seriously, either as the source of religious truth or as great literary narratives which have informed the consciousness, the imagination, the language, and the literature of the West, as you said in your introduction to me. So I wanted people who took these stories seriously. I didn't want any people who were playing with the stories, playing at the stories, who were doing this just because it was talk. Second, I wanted to be sure that everyone who participated would be someone I wouldn't mind spending a long winter with if I were isolated and marooned somewhere.
That's a good one.
And every one of them fitted that group. Obviously, we started with some people we knew. I mean, I had worked with Bharati Mukherjee, who lives here in the Bay Area, in my series World of Ideas. I knew Stephen Mitchell for years. Stephen Mitchell, I'm sure you know, lives here in the Bay Area, translator, has done his own translation of Genesis. I wanted Stephen because he brings, as the son of a Jewish doctor in Brooklyn who's been a practicing Buddhist now for a quarter of a century, he brings some wonderful insights into the world of religion and the spirit. I knew of Robert Alter, who also is here in the Bay Area, marvelous literary critic who has his own translation as well of Genesis. I wanted them, and we branched out from the people we knew to people who were referred to us by others we consulted. I mean, I would call Catholic bishops, say, who do you know is the best on the Bible these days in your tradition? Who's doing the most interesting research? A lot of women in this series. Women are doing the most imaginative work, the most cutting-edge work, I think, in the world of theology and biblical scholarship today. Well, you can understand that. For so long, they were denied equality at the table.
And people like Elaine Pagels.
Elaine Pagels, Renita Weems at Vanderbilt University, Phyllis Tribble. There's this marvelous moment where we're discussing Potiphar's wife and how Potiphar's wife tried to seduce Joseph. And about 15 minutes into the discussion, this voice speaks up and says, I hate this story. And it's Phyllis Tribble. And I say, why do you hate it, Phyllis? And she said, because it's misogynist. And she goes on then to explain why she thinks this story is misogynist, why she thinks much of the Bible is misogynist. And then for the next 15 to 20 minutes, Michael, we had the most lively discussion about what it's like to read the Bible from different perspectives. I once said to a reporter back from Vietnam when I was at the White House with Lyndon Johnson, who's telling the truth out there? He thought a moment and he said, everyone. Everyone sees what's happening through the lens of his own experience. And of course, that's the way we've all interpreted the Bible through these years. And Phyllis was saying, you've got to help you folks. You've got to realize why these stories have sometimes been so hard on women. We had a wonderful discussion growing out of that. So we have a very mixed group. I think we wound up with 2 Muslims, 4 or 5 Catholics, 6 or 7 Protestants, a Hindu, a lot of people like that. We had a psychotherapist, a journalist, 2 or 3 novelists, several poets, a variety of people, some of whom were profoundly believers in their tradition and some of whom, as I said earlier, are not sure.
I'm speaking with Bill Moyers, creator of Genesis, A Living Conversation, both the television series and the book. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Bill, I was struck by the fact that you began the Genesis television series with the first murder. It didn't begin with the creation, but you began with the first murder. Why?
This is a 10-part series, and PBS called up and said has been running every Sunday for 10 weeks, but PBS called us up and said, we have an hour in prime time at 8 o'clock on this particular Wednesday night, and would you like to begin the series there? I said, I want to begin it there because if it's not going to be the same night every week, every Wednesday night, instead it's going to be Sundays. I don't want people to get used to that idea. But let's run one of the shows, one that I find particularly crackling, to put there where people sort of will draw attention to the series. So I thought that the group I had assembled for the first murder, the story of Cain and Abel, would be far more interesting to more people than to start with the story of Adam and Eve in the image of God, where I have more traditional biblical scholars there. For the first murder, which is the story that's resonated perhaps more than any other story in literature from Genesis through our time, the first murder would make people attract people to see the Bible differently from how they had seen it. So I had novelists and poets come and discuss this, masters of the craft, who were really good at their literary narrative themselves. We have John Barth, a prolific novelist, Mary Gordon, a wonderful woman who comes out of a Catholic tradition, writing powerful novels now. Oscar Huelis, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Mambo King's play Songs of Love. Charles Johnson, who won the National Book Award for Middle Passages about the slave trade. Mary Kellerman, who lives on the West Coast here, who is a wonderful mystery writer who has a large following. And we sat around and I let them discuss this story first as story, and then inevitably, as always happens, they get into the issue of belief and what it means to them personally. So we started with the first murder because it's a very popular theme throughout literature, murder, and it comes from, this is the first murder on record in Western tradition, and we have a rip-roaring discussion about it with some very powerful theological and religious insights, even from people who are agnostic.
What's interesting, particularly about that story, Cain and Abel, and some of the other stories that come through in Genesis, is the extraordinary contemporary quality of the images, the archetypes, the actions, the interactions. What about that?
Well, you have all of the themes in modern life reflected in these stories: sibling rivalry, jealousy, violence, the role between crime and punishment. You have parents who play favorites. I mean, let's face it, this is one of the more intriguing and formidable discussions that we had, because we realized, as we were talking about it, that the first murder grows out of a religious act. Cain, a farmer, brought the fruits of the soil to God in this story. Abel, his younger brother, brings the firstborn sheep. He's a shepherd. And Cain and God prefers Abel's offering over Cain. Cain, in jealousy, rises up and slays his brother out of vengeance. So here were two boys, young men, bringing religious offerings to their God, and the result is the first murder. The fact that this pattern gets picked up and repeated in the stories of Esau and Jacob, Ishmael and Isaac, right on down to the century, you know, runs this religiously spilled red thread of blood from east of Eden to Beirut, Belfast, and Bosnia, says something about what's in our human nature, this conflict that constantly has to be addressed and has to be nurtured if we're going to turn away from the violent instinct that is in us. So we had a really, really interesting discussion on that. And another discussion on the whole fact that Abel was innocent. Mary Gordon speaks to this. She says, this is the hopeless moment for me, the realization that Abel died even though Abel was innocent. All he had done was to offer the firstborn sheep to God as an offering, and for this he dies. And she said, this is what makes it so hard to believe in God. Innocence and purity don't save you. Didn't save the Jews, didn't save the Native Americans, didn't save the African soul into slavery. Innocence and purity have nothing to do with your fate. And this is the moment in the narrative, says Mary Gordon, when doubt becomes both comprehensible and perhaps inevitable. It's that kind of discussion we have.
Also, something that runs throughout the dialogues is the interpretation of Genesis, and this is true of the whole Bible, as literal versus metaphorical, mythical. And there are different interpretations. And if you look at it literally, it takes on a whole nother perspective. If you look at it metaphorically, it's something totally different. What about that?
What I did was to ask the participants to come, to not shy away from the stories in Genesis as a religious document. I think these stories are true in the way all great poetry is true, by pointing to the imagination of the human heart and to their revelation of what lies within the human character. And these sources have been, through the centuries, inspired great religious loyalty and great religious beliefs. So we asked the people to come from that. But Robert Alter comes as a literary critic, where Lewis Smeads from the Fuller Theological Seminary further down the coast here comes as a believing Christian. Mary Gordon comes as a skeptical Catholic. John Barth comes as an acknowledged agnostic. But they, by treating these stories as the source of religious truth, they are able to discuss them without having to buy into them, and it produces some very interesting conversation. But we all interpret the Bible differently. If you do believe that, as the fundamentalists do, that God is the author of these stories and they literally mean what they mean, you'll interpret them one way. If you are, however, on your own, trying to compose your own interior music to the discord of our times, you're going to, and you see and hear the poetry of other people trying to express their experiences, you're going to read them a different way.
I would imagine that you, throughout doing this series, heard the echo of Joseph Campbell in your ears, and the nature of stories and the power of stories and the power of myth. Did you?
I heard the echo of Joseph Campbell, the echo of Harvey Cox, the theologian at Harvard who talks about the importance of stories that bind people's tale together and gives them a sense of perspective on their lives. Bob Coles, who's spent his career gathering the stories of America, the stories of children, discussing the stories, the power of stories in our lives. I heard the echoes here of everybody who believes that stories are the way we organize our response to the world. And that's why we took the 10 great stories from Adam and Eve on through Joseph and his brothers and talked about them as stories. Some people believe they're stories about God's reaction with the human race. Other people believe that they're efforts of human beings to explain their own yearnings and their own aspirations. And some people believe they're folk tales like the folk tales of New Guinea. So you get a really interesting mix of perspectives on these. But they are stories, and stories are the way we compose our response to the world.
You know, in some way, in observing your work over the years, it seems as if one of the things that runs through all of your work is that you create a forum where people can tell their stories. Is that what you try and do?
I never thought of it consciously that way, but I love the sound of the human voice. I love the voices I heard as a boy growing up in East Texas, my neighbors talking across the fence, my mother and father in bed on a Saturday night, my brother and his girlfriend sitting on the porch, the sound of preachers from the pulpit, the sound of wonderful teachers reading Shelley and Bryant and William Cullen Bryant and Keats and all of that. The human voice is part of my memory and part of my response to life itself. And I just love to hear people talk about their ideas and debrief themselves in a way with someone like you're doing here. I just find that to be the way I make sense of the world, by borrowing what I can from people to whom I listen. Life for me, as I'm sure it is for you, probably why we're doing this, is a continuing course in adult education.
Right,
my own.
Exactly. Lifelong learning.
Yeah, it gives me the chance to listen to other people's stories. But there's nothing more powerful to me than a human face, which the television camera does. Well, television does two things well, sports and talking heads, right, and the sound of the human voice, at which radio is so much the master.
There's something about it. You mentioned sports and talking heads. The two things that are equal there, are they're usually the ones that are good, or they're both live.
Yes.
So that the life is still present. It hasn't been produced out of it, that there's a liveliness that's present there, that you don't know what's going to happen. NBC can't produce a space shuttle launch. I mean, it's going to happen the way it happens. They can just be there to record it, right?
Exactly.
And so there's something special about that liveness, that just being in open dialogue and having a living conversation, as you subtitled the series and the book.
Well, in these 10 hours on Genesis, you do get the essence of the authentic exchange that took place in real time while we were taping. And that's what I've tried to do over the years, is to edit for authenticity. Obviously, if you're doing produced television like we do, you can't include everything,
right,
do everything that happened at the original time. But the moral task of the producer and the editor is to make sure that what finally appears does have the authentic spontaneity and the essence of the experience as the people lived it at the moment.
Yeah, going back to a series that you did, which I thought was really quite wonderful, was Bill Moyer's Journal. And what I remember about that series was that Most often you went to the home turf of the person you were talking to. So I remember you walking the grounds of Aspen Institute with Mortimer Adler. I remember you sitting on the back porch of James Dickey's home on a lake in Carolina. And there was something just really kind of natural and homespun and organic about that process. And it occurred to me that, and I don't know this now, I'm just asking you now, that you must have a very sensitive camera crew, spend time there with the person beforehand, because they're obviously feeling very comfortable and they're very relaxed and very at ease. Tell me a little bit about how you went about that.
Well, I've worked over the years with some of the finest producers and camera people in the business. People seem to want to do this work with me, and I've been able to avail myself of some really talented people who are deeply concerned about the authenticity of the experience. Coming out of the South, as I do, where, not so much now, but it used to, place was powerful. Place talked to you when you were growing up in the South, and you absorbed place, so that I wanted to go where people were. One of my favorites is a documentary that I did many years ago with Maya Angelou. We took her back to her hometown in Stamps, Arkansas, and there's that moment when she's been describing what it was like as a little black girl and growing up in this town to go across the tracks to the other side to buy second day bread at the white store, and how it was a hostile world, and she often was afraid of what would be said to her or the gestures that would be shown to her. So here she is many years later. We're walking. I said, well, let's walk over there. We walk up this dirt road. We come to the railroad track. I haven't noticed, but Maria's been drifting back behind me. I'm about 3-4 feet ahead of her, aiming to go across the track. Suddenly she reaches out, gets my arms, and said, I tell you what, Bill, I can't even go there now. I tell you, you stay on this side of the tracks with me, and we'll both be safe. And we turn and walk off, and the cameraman, David Grubin, is right behind both of us doing all of this, and he just moves with the action so that you're never conscious of the camera, but you're never unconscious of the reality of that moment. And it's one of those defining moments for me of about the authenticity of journalism and how it's so important to be faithful to what actually happens.
Yeah, and it's so at odds with the way journalism, particularly television journalism, has evolved. I mean, it's almost like they're out there creating the news rather than just recording what's happening. And I think of things like tabloid television and schlock journalism. I mean, these things are, there's like a kind of like, let's make it happen. And we've already got the story in mind before we even get there. It's already produced before I even shoot it. What about that?
There is a lot of that hustling of reality in order to produce a preconceived notion about what a story should be. I've been fortunate over the years because, well, we have to raise every penny of every production that I put on public broadcasting. But once I do that, I'm free to do justice to what I believe is important and what I value. So going out in the field, going to report, going to where the people are, as you say, going to their homes or their studies or their laboratories, being on location with them, their location, not a location that's contrived in a studio, has been very important to the kind of journalism I do. You're right, Michael, it's disappearing because so much of it is now done on artificial turf, so to speak, in studios or on sets or behind the doors of a very carefully arranged set. And there's too little reporting now in the field about what's really happening for people for whom it's really happening.
I recall that the first interviews you did with Joseph Campbell, it was on Bill Moyer's Journal, I believe, was a two-parter, and you did it at the American Indian Museum, where he had first encountered Native American artifacts as a little boy of 5 or 6 years old.
You have a marvelous memory. That's exactly right. That was 20 years ago, I think.
It was vivid because he was obviously at home there. I mean, it was like took him right back to his childhood.
He told me about his father bringing him there for the first time. I think he said he was about 8 or 9 at that time. And he walked in there. It's the American Museum of Natural History on the west side of New York. And he came in there and he said, my mind exploded. I saw these totems. I saw these masks. I saw these icons of the Native American culture. And I knew this was the reality I wanted to probe for the rest of my life.
I'm speaking with Bill Moyers, the creator of Genesis, A Living Conversation, on PBS and in the form of a book. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Bill, going back to Genesis, you mentioned the misogynist nature of some of the text, according to one of the presenters in the series. And it occurs to me that in Genesis, there's a great deal of what could be called misogyny. I mean, just the whole idea of the two creation stories and how woman is seen as